from Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse on the campus of UWL. Thank you very much for joining us today. We've got an interesting discussion. We're talking about some new mental health resources, a strategy guide, if you will, that's available at the conclusion of a project that was funded by the Advancing a Healthier Wisconsin Endowment. And joining us are a couple of people from two local outfits that are part of how that project is going to benefit the greater La Crosse area and our listeners here. Diana Diaz-Granados is a familiar voice to this program. In fact, she was with us just a few weeks ago and is the project director for Better Together in La Crosse County. Diana, welcome back to Newsmakers.
Thank you, Ezra, for having me.
Catherine Kolkmeyer is the executive director of the La Crosse Medical Health Science Consortium. Catherine, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So let's, I don't know if there is a short answer to this question, but basically $20 million was given to 10 different organizations all across the state of Wisconsin from the Advancing a Healthier Wisconsin Endowment. It was spent on different aspects of a project related to mental health, to behavioral health. Diana, tell me about the project and how you got involved in it.
Yes, Ezra. So this was an investment by the endowment of $20 million, as you said. We were one of 10 communities that were selected, and I'll let Catherine talk about that. How that happened. And for 8 years, we have been working with our community here in La Crosse County to affect change around youth mental health. We've talked before how we've, worked to increase mental health literacy. We've trained teachers and parents and our police officers and worked with our police officers to, understand youth mental health challenges. And have also made data available around mental health more public, and so that schools and our institutions know where that data is located and how to use it.
Catherine, Diana was talking about how everything came together, all these organizations getting involved in this project. Tell me about that.
Sure. The Advancing a Healthier Wisconsin Endowment is part of the Medical College of Wisconsin. This is funding that was made available through the Blue Cross Blue Shield conversion in 2004. So that put money into both of the medical schools to make available for community projects. And the consortium has actually been funded several times through this funding mechanism, mostly for alcohol projects. And this project came about in 2016. We were made aware of it, that they were trying something a little bit different. Instead of being traditional grant makers, they were aiming to be more strategic about it. So rather than making some money available for projects that people had already developed, they wanted to see if they could bring a cohort of communities together to work on something in cooperation with one another. And so this was a way that they were able to, they chose the topic of mental health and put the challenge out to the state to say, if you have a community that's interested in this, tell us who your team is and tell us what your needs are, and then we'll all work on it together. And so we became one of those 10 communities, and the consortium brought together our health and education and community partners to apply for the funding, which then put us into that cohort working with the other 9 communities to build projects that that addressed mental health in one form or another that was appropriate to each community itself.
Diana, did each of these 10 organizations kind of take a different tack on their approach to mental health, or is there sort of a unifying thread throughout all the projects that people have brought up?
Each community, worked within the population that the community identified as the most, most pressing. And so there were coalitions that worked on youth mental health, but there were also coalitions that worked on adult mental health. Some coalitions focused on increasing access to resources regarding like emergency plans for someone that might be suffering or experiencing suicidality. And then we had one of our tribe, one of our coalitions that was with the Lac des Flambeaux tribe, look at bringing back cultural traditions as a form of improving mental wellness and social connectedness.
What has Better Together in La Crosse County been looking at as part of this 8-year project?
We focused on decreasing mental health stigma by increasing mental health literacy. Really, helping our community understand that mental health is part of our physical health, that the importance of social connectedness and understanding that being a young person right now in 2024 is really difficult. It's challenging that our kids now being so connected to phones and screens and social media has added more challenges than maybe their parents had experienced. That asking someone if they're okay and if they were thinking of hurting themselves or killing themselves is not the wrong thing to do. It's actually the right thing to do. When we first started this project, there was a belief that asking someone about suicide might instigate or might trigger someone, and we know from research that that isn't true. That we need to be talking about our mental health, just like we know we talk about our physical health.
Well, the brain is, after all, part of the body, isn't it?
Absolutely. And those things that we know that are good for other parts of our body, we've also now learned that they're also good for our brain. So good nutrition, proper sleep, being outside and getting some exercise, having a physical connection, social connections, those are all good for our mental wellness.
So let's talk about one of the things that's new is this behavioral health strategy guide, as I understand it. Catherine, tell me what's behind that strategy guide.
Well, the strategy guide is really the collective lessons learned of all of the projects around the state. And so we work with not just these 10 communities, but also with an academic partner, which is based in the Medical College of Wisconsin. And they helped bring together all of the findings of the 10 communities over the 8-year projects and to categorize these strategies to make them available online so that other communities can access them. So that way you can look at those that are community-based, those that are school-based, and all of the different types of strategies that worked in different communities so that we can learn a little bit more about how to approach it around the state and around the country.
And when you say strategies, that could mean a lot of different things. What are some examples of the strategies that these organizations have investigated?
Well, some of them are organized programs that are curricula. So, for instance, one that we use in our community is mental health first aid. I know Diana can tell us a lot more about that as one of their trainers. There's a program called Sources of Strength that was used in one of the other communities that was very successful there. But other times it was not so much planned or not so much the contained strategies, but ones that were developed by the communities themselves. So, for instance, one that is listed that was developed here is the work that we've been doing on developing a resilient and trauma-informed community. So really, it's just a number of different types of programs and ideas that other communities might be able to look into to see if it's a good fit for their population.
The different people that were involved in this work in the La Crosse area, how do you know who to bring to the table and what their role needs to be?
Well, when we started, since we began this with the consortium, we began working with health, public health, healthcare, education, K-12 and higher education partners, and eventually began to reach out to youth serving organizations, to our local law enforcement, those who had a role in specific projects. Sometimes that would bring partners to the table, but we started with those who were already working together on community improvements and added on as it seemed appropriate. And so our group really grew organically from the beginning. and has continued to do so over the years.
One of the strategies you mentioned Diana being involved in was mental health first aid. The first time I ever heard that phrase, Diana, was in our last conversation, which involved a few different people from our community giving some advice on people sort of just taking stock of their own mental well-being. So I want to learn more about this concept, mental health first aid, because as soon as I heard you say it the last time we talked, it's like I had this light bulb moment that, oh, that's important to know about, just like taking care of, you know, a physical injury is important to know about, because we all, and mental health injuries may happen even more often. So what is mental health first aid? How did you learn about that or begin to use that kind of terminology?
Mental health first aid is a certification, just like first aid, you know. So it was brought to the United States from Australia by the National Council for Behavioral Health, and we have, you know, with Better Together, have grown the number of trainers that we have in our community. We have a cadre of police officers that are trained in mental health first aid. There are different modules. So there's a module that is focused on youth, so youth mental health first aid, that teaches adults about youth development, about youth mental health, kind of signs and symptoms, and then how to respond to a young person that may be experiencing a mental health challenge or a crisis. We, you know, just like in a regular first aid course, you know, you don't learn to diagnose someone who is, someone who's having, you know, some kind of a heart issue, but how to respond if someone did have a heart attack. So same in mental health first aid. It's not about diagnosing mental health disorders, but it's understanding what to do if you see someone that seems to be struggling, and kind of giving that vocabulary and just that, you know, the skills and confidence to be able to talk about mental health and offer support.
Along those lines, it must take some time for people to become comfortable with that. And obviously we can't do the entire training here on the radio, but like, are there small takeaways that people that we can include in this conversation, or something that people need to be aware of if they think somebody is going through a mental health crisis, and how they could immediately interact with that person?
Absolutely. The action plan around that's taught in mental health first aid is focused on being an active listener, of assessing for it, it's for signs and of a possible suicide, of listening non-judgmentally, of giving assurance and information. So being able to be a listener and say the reassurance that what you're feeling is normal, and many people feel this way, and we can connect you to an existing resource for someone that may be having thoughts of suicide or concerned about another person, a young person. They can call 988 and have someone they can call or text 988 and have support by telephone. And then how to connect someone to local resources. So we often, here in the La Crosse area, we're very fortunate that in our primary care settings, our pediatricians are a good first step for a parent or a caregiver to talk to be able to access resources, mental health resources, through their pediatrician.
Catherine, one of the terms, I just want to do some terminology setting here. We see that term behavioral health used a lot. Is that just an alternative way to say mental health, or when I think of behavioral health, I usually think of like mental health counselors.
I will do my best, and Diana can help me out with this one too. Behavioral health is a little bit broader than mental health, as I understand it, because behavioral health is referring to a whole range of behaviors that people undertake. And so it's not necessarily just specific to mental health, but also things like substance use is part of behavioral health, or ways that people well, like ways that people behave as a result of their mental health. And so it's more about the decision making that people engage in, the lifestyles that people engage in, and how those can be addressed. So it's just a broader term.
One of the partners that you worked with, Diana, in this, or that you do work with in this mental health first aid work that you were talking about is the police department. The police are so often like the first point of contact for people who are in a mental health crisis. And we've talked on this program before about different approaches that that police are taking to try to differentiate between somebody who's in a mental health crisis and somebody who is in the midst of, you know, committing a crime or something like that, and maybe even adjusting who they send into that situation. Why is law enforcement such an important partner in this kind of effort and sort of bringing them up to speed on current thinking surrounding mental health problems?
Yeah, we're very fortunate in this community of how what a strong commitment our police chief and has to mental health. You know, our connection really at first with mental health first aid with the police department was really to train the police officers to and how for them to take care of their own mental health. It is a very stressful job, and and so to be able to have police officers trained to be able to, you know, work with their colleagues and train their colleagues and recognizing signs and symptoms of extreme stress, of PTSD from something that they may have seen on the job, and giving them strategies on how to take care of themselves and how to ask for help was really important and has been essential to I think, you know, improving the just the well-being of our, you know, local police force. They have been such an important partner for this community, and being able to offer training to in area schools, to other organizations, to be part of, you know, training days that we've done and been able to train, you know, large groups of people at the same time. They've just been, you know, a fantastic partner.
This is Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking today with Diana Diaz-Granados from Better Together in La Crosse County and Catherine Kolkmeyer from the La Crosse Medical Health Science Consortium. And I'm excited to continue our conversation in just a moment. If you would like to reach out to our program, you can email us anytime. Newsmakers@WPR.org is our email address. That's newsmakers@WPR.org. Our conversation will continue in just a moment here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall with Diana Diaz-Granados and Catherine Kolkmeyer, and we are talking about, among other things, a newly launched resource that is available. It's a behavioral health strategy guide, and we've talked a lot about what went into the sort of the research, I use that term very loosely, behind the guide, this 8-year program that Better Together and others have been involved in. Tell me where people can find the actual information that we've been talking about, the Behavioral Health Strategy Guide.
They could go directly to www.mcw.edu/strategy-guide. And they could also go to bettertogetherlacrosse.org. That's bettertogetherlacrosse.org.
Okay, and that's your organization, and you'll link the strategy guide there at your website too.
Correct. We'll put it on our resources page. Also on our website, we have, you know, people can explore some of the work that we've done over the past 8 years. We've developed some skill sheets for families to use with young people, but also applicable to young adults and adults on building resilience. We're linked there. It's also to the Resilient and Trauma-Informed Community, which is a website where we've spent past several years talking about the impact of trauma and adverse childhood experiences on our health, on our mental health, and just a little bit more about the project. So that's at bettertogetherlacrosse.org.
Okay. Catherine, now that this is hitting the public, so to speak, the Behavioral Health Strategy Guide is out in the wild. What are you looking forward to next? What are next steps in this project from your perspective?
You know, we're actually having those conversations right now. And, you know, mental health is something that is always going to be an issue to be worked on, just like physical health. It's something that can be addressed forever. And so we are really looking at different ways to approach it. As this funding comes to an end, it gives us an opportunity to reevaluate the work that we're doing and think about how we can look at it more broadly and as appropriately as we can for this community that we live in. Just recently, we were talking about, as Diana mentioned earlier in the program, that there are wider and easier ways to approach mental health that also affect physical health, like healthier lifestyles and what sort of impacts we have there. We're also going to continue working on what Diana just mentioned, the Resilient and Trauma-Informed Community effort, trying to educate the community about the impacts of adverse childhood experiences, the importance of resilience, the importance of having empathy skills, and learning to better relate to each other just as human beings. So there's a lot of opportunities right now. We're right in the middle of looking at that planning and seeing how we can sustain some of this work. We're getting some of our partners involved in taking on some of the work. One of the outcomes of the work that we've been doing is a report that shares data of the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which Diana can tell us a lot more about if you'd like to hear about that. And that is going to be held within the La Crosse County Health Department. So we're excited that they're going to be taking on that role of maintaining that database. So there's lots of different possibilities of where we can jump off into more work in the future.
What about you, Diana? What are you looking forward to as this phase of the project concludes?
Continuing the work, because as Catherine said, you know, we need to continue to kind of spread that awareness of the importance of focusing on our mental health, on ensuring that our youth are, you know, recognize that stress is a normal thing, and that we all have good days and bad days, and that we need those skills to be able to get through kind of rough times. I'm excited that we will continue working on a specific aspect of mental health around youth vaping. So that's some work that will continue, and making sure that, you know, people are not, you know, do not vape, and because we know that impacts their mental health. So I think there's definitely a lot of opportunity to continue and that forward momentum that we have on youth mental health.
So we live in the Midwest. We all know a certain stock of people who are kind of stiff upper lip, put your best foot forward, suck it up, buttercup kind of approach to life. How do you talk to people? How do you begin this kind of conversation with people who think that that talk about like the fragility of our own mental health, it just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy?
I would say, you know, if there's been a silver lining about the pandemic, it has been that we are talking more about mental health, and that we hear everyone, you know, from all social strata, of all backgrounds and races, of our athletes and politicians and leaders talking about the importance of mental health. And I think that's the more we normalize those conversations, the more people recognize that stiff upper lip and pull yourself up by your bootstraps is not as effective for everyone. And that talking about mental health and just being kind and recognizing maybe some of the behaviors, whether it's, you know, taking in substances, alcohol, is not benefiting you and is not, you know, helping your mental health. I think the more we talk about that, the more people will maybe start changing those attitudes.
One of the projects that we worked alongside in southwestern Wisconsin in Grant County, and it was a 5-county area that was covered by that project, was focusing specifically on farmers and the farming community and mental health as a the stigma that's associated with mental health in that community, but also looking at the increases in suicides among farmers, which has been nationally noticed. And I think that they've made some great strides in talking to people who are in the farming community and how mental health really does need to be talked about. I've been excited to see coverage like that, even at the national level. There was an article just a couple of weeks ago, and I think, believe it was in the Washington Post, talking about mental health in the farming community and how important it is to talk about it. So I think that like Diana said, with the pandemic, people are starting to talk about that, and that's a really good sign.
Do you see that trend continuing as more people sort of see their friends and neighbors, or maybe experience people who they actually know who are talking about mental health and realizing that it isn't just like quote unquote crazy people who go to a counselor or seek treatment of some kind?
Definitely.
And I think also understanding that not all mental health requires, you know, a medical treatment or a medication. It's looking at our own, you know, lifestyle, our behaviors, our sleep, those things that our phone use and screen time and how those things are impact, you know, impact our health and our mental health.
As with most social changes, we're seeing that start with youth, and that you know, youth are very, very open, talking to each other, talking to their teachers, talking to their families about their mental health. Kids talk to each other about any medications or any treatments or meditation work or things that they're doing to try to improve their mental health. And as that becomes normalized with younger people, that eventually creeps its way up into older populations, as we see with all sorts of other trends at a social level. So that's an encouraging trend as well.
I think throughout history, it's probably usually younger people / youth who are early adopters of emerging trends. But is there something different about this era of youth in terms of the struggles that they've been through, or, you know, is there something more profound that they are facing and dealing with differently than other generations have?
Absolutely. We see in the data that mental health indicators that start trending in the wrong way, it really escalates around 2012, and right around the time that kids started getting cell phones and smartphones and social media. And so the direct targeting that social media companies have done to, you know, everyone, adults included, that is a greater challenge for young people that other generations did not have to deal with. We're dealing with it, you know, that same, you know, marketing from tobacco companies and, you know, vaping. There's the access to information. The access is just so much greater now than ever before. That speed of change of everything in society is it more difficult to deal with, I think, for young people.
And I think that it also results in that speed of change is faster than any parents or grandparents have ever had to deal with. And so keeping up with it has been really difficult for the older people who are responsible for those youth and young people. That makes it difficult to properly respond. And if you don't have an experience to base it on yourself, then a lot of people get left with fewer resources than they'd like to have. So that makes it tricky as well.
So people are listening to our conversation. We've obviously been talking about about this new behavioral health strategy guide that's available. And we've been hearing from Diana from Better Together in La Crosse County and Catherine from La Crosse Medical Health Science Consortium. But what's, if somebody is learning more about themselves or hearing maybe for the first time hearing something that lets them know that they need more information about their own mental health, as we close our conversation today, what should that person do? Where should they turn for that information? Diana?
Say, talking to a trusted friend, leaning into maybe a medical provider that if they have a medical provider that they can talk to and say that they are struggling, if they can access someone to talk to by dialing 211, if they are really feeling in more of a crisis, and we have a new federal line for mental health crises, the 988. So that's where that's where I would go.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Good advice. Diana Diaz-Granados from Better Together in La Crosse County, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me again. Ezra, it's always a pleasure.
And Catherine Kolkmeyer is the Executive Director of La Crosse Medical Health Science Consortium. Catherine, thank you for being here.
Thanks for inviting me. Appreciate it.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to hear part of this conversation that you might have missed or hear another program that we've aired in the past, you can find our entire archive at WPR.org. Just click on shows and scroll down to Newsmakers. That's WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse on the campus of UWL. And coincidentally or not, we're talking about an event that is coming up next week at UWL. It's an event celebrating International Women's Day. And we have two guests here to talk about International Women's Day with us. First of all, Erica Kuhnman is with the Women's History, with the American Association of University Women La Crosse branch, and they're celebrating Women's History Month as well as International Women's Day coming up next week. Erica, thank you very much for joining us on Newsmakers today.
Thank you.
With us as well is Gifty Amidoda, and Gifty is from Ghana originally and is currently a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse and will be a panelist on an event coming up at UWL for International Women's Day. And we'll tell you more about that event as our conversation goes on. But first, let me welcome Gifty. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to talk about your story, Gifty, a little bit, and learn from you what you experienced growing up. Tell me what life is like when you were growing up in Ghana.
I did not live in a nuclear family growing up. In my culture, we have a lot of family members living together in the same house. So I grew up with a lot of cousins, with my uncles in the house, with my aunties in the house. So this is the kind of place I lived in. And also, I went to school with my cousins, walked to school with my cousins when I was young. So this is what it looked like for me.
How many people would you say lived in the house? Were people coming and going from the house as their living situations changed, or was there a pretty consistent number of people living in your home?
In my paternal grandfather's house, that's where I lived at first. Here we had two of my aunties and one uncle of mine in the house, so they were permanently living there, but it got to a point where one of my aunties had to move out of the house. They all had their apartments in the building, but she had to move out, I think, because her family grew bigger. So that's it. On my paternal grandfather's side too, when we had to go there, when my mom had to go back to school, it was a much bigger house with much more cousins in there and uncles and aunties. So with them too, that had a lot more of traffic coming in and going out, going on, because some of the uncles did not live there fully. And so their families just came to visit sometimes, but they had rooms in the house. They had apartments in the house. So they would come for possibly some vacations and then leave to the cities where they lived. So yeah, this is how it looked like.
So we're talking about International Women's Day, which is next week, and you're speaking on a panel about that. So tell me about what life is like for women and girls in Ghana. What did you see as far as either opportunities or lack of opportunities for women and girls in Ghana?
I would say that there's a bit of both, a bit in the, I think in the late 90s, there was a great campaign concerning girl child education. So this brought in a lot of girls into education. And right now, I'm sure I do not have the figures, but then I'm sure you would averagely see more girls in school than boys. Now, that being said, there are other times that girls are not that privileged in the sense that I have been teaching for, I taught for about 18 years before coming here. And in my line of work, what I had met mostly was poverty, I would say, because there were students who could not afford sanitary towels, so they could not stay in school. So, and this is also, I can blame this on the powers that be in the country, because there is a lot of tax on sanitary towels, making it expensive for people. So, aside the fact that I used to teach in inner city urban places, there's also the fact that these things are expensive for some people to afford. So there is this in, I don't know if I'll call it inequality when it comes to access to education, because students, female students are not able to stay in class all the time because they have to deal with this period poverty, it is called.
So just the high cost of feminine hygiene products is actually limiting people's educations. So
Go ahead.
when you're a graduate student at UWL, where did you do your undergraduate work? Your training to become a teacher?
Oh, I did that in Ghana.
Okay.
I was trained in Ghana to be a teacher.
And are you studying education at UWL?
Yeah, this is a master's in education. It's an MSED, Master of Science in Education,
Okay.
Student Affairs Administration.
What are you hoping to do when you finish?
I hope to support students in a tertiary education, because this is what my program is tailored to do. This is actually my dream. This is what I came to study. So I will not be in the classroom anymore when I get back, but I will be still working in student support, like being a student advisor, student support services. Yeah, this is what generally my program's about.
Okay.
Yeah.
Erica, I want to talk to you about this event that's coming up. It's in celebration of International Women's Day, and it's an event that's sponsored annually by the AAUW of La Crosse. It's coming up Tuesday evening from 5 to 7 at the Bluffs Room at the UWL Student Union. Tell me what people can expect, who would like to attend.
AAUW is one of the sponsors. We also have seven other co-sponsors,
okay,
just to make that clear.
Sure.
It's a free event. There's free parking there. And it ties in nicely with what Gifty's saying about the lack of feminine products for school. We are doing a donation, a collection of menstrual products. And we'll do That's that good. To support women's shelters and the local schools and correctional facilities. So nice tie-in.
Mm-hmm.
What they can expect is we're going to have three women. Gifty's one of them from Ghana. We have a professor from Japan and a exchange student from Malaysia. So the three of them will be sharing their experiences in their country of origin as women and what they've experienced in the U.S., kind of compare and contrast and share with us what maybe surprised them the most about the U.S.
Okay. So working on an event like this, I know the theme from year to year is a little bit different. How did you land on inspiring inclusion for this year's theme?
That is from the International Women's Day.
Okay.
Committee. They put out the theme and we
okay.
just build on
it. Okay. So as you're going about planning and you get to reflect on the theme that has been, you know, chosen on behalf of these organizations all around the country and the world. What particular thoughts came to your mind as far as inclusion and the importance of raising that awareness for women, not only internationally but even here in town?
Well, I think that we can say really clearly that women's rights all over the world are being threatened and taken away. So it's important to focus on how we can be included in decisions that are made for women, about women. And internationally, what we have in common and how we can work together, action steps we can take to improve the situations.
Is there a charge for the event on Tuesday? What do people have to do? Registration, anything like that?
Nope, nothing like that. Just show up.
Okay.
And bring menstrual products to donate.
Okay. And it's at 5 o'clock on Tuesday, March 5th at the Student Union at UWL, right?
Right. The doors open at 5 and there will be our 8 sponsoring organizations will have tables of information as well as other organizations, local organizations will have tables of information. So there'll be some cookies and coffee. And the program will start at 5:30.
Do you have the list of sponsors in front of you? Who else is involved in putting the event together?
I do. Thank you for asking that. It is AAUW, the League of Women Voters of La Crosse, the FSPA, the Women's Fund of Greater La Crosse, Viterbo, UWL, the International Women's Group, and YWCA La Crosse.
All right. So quite a collection. It's many hands make light work, I guess, as the saying goes, right?
Yep, we're all in it together.
So I'm interested in learning a little bit more. You talked about the event sort of comparing and contrasting life between the different experiences of the panelists. Gifty, what about you? How long have you been in the U.S.?
Oh, I've been here since August 26th, I think last year, August. So that's about
6 months or something like that.
7 months.
Okay.
I think.
Okay. Mm. What was it a big culture shock when you got here? What has been different for you?
Difference would be, I think that the time difference is really big, so it took me some time to adjust. But then the real difference I saw was in food.
Okay.
You know, I realized that there is a vast difference in what we eat and what is American food. So that was very different for me. That my actual shock when it came to food was that there was so much presence of sugar in everything. I found sugar in everything I tasted that was said to mm-hmm. be, even if it had spice, even if it had pepper, there was still some sugar in there, which was surprising for me because back home we did not mix pepper with sugar. at all. So that was one big shock for me.
What food do you miss from back home?
Oh, what food do I miss? I miss the akpala, which is also called banku, but I am able to make it here from time to time. Not as often, but then I'm able to make it here from time to time. It's not the same as what I had back in Ghana, but there's a semblance of it I get from Amazon and
Okay.
then I make it.
What is it?
Yeah. It's made of corn flour and then cassava. You know what cassava is, right?
Yes.
Yes. So cassava is made into a dough. Corn is made into a dough as well.
Okay.
And then these two doughs are put together, mixed into a paste. You add some more water to it, put it on fire, and then stir it up until it's cooked into a well put together doughy dish. This is eaten with a sauce made from okra.
Okay.
We prefer it a lot with okra.
All right.
And yeah,
So
that's generally.
cassava is a like cassava looks a bit like it's a root. It looks a bit like potatoes. Does it taste anything like potatoes?
Yeah, I think it tastes like Irish potatoes, not sweet potatoes.
Right,
Sweet
right.
potatoes are sweet, but
Yeah.
cassava is not sweet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, now that we've got food out of the way. No, so you said it's different here. There's a lot of sugar and everything. I think a lot of people would agree with you. But has sugar or no, has there been anything that you've enjoyed since coming to the US that you're interested in taking back to Ghana with you?
Food-wise, yes. I like soft pretzels. These are my most favorite discovery here in America.
They are
You know, when I
miraculous
came,
little creations, aren't they?
I love it. I love it. I
Yeah.
love it. Yesterday, I was on the internet looking for where I could find some in La Crosse. Like, there should be something for me here.
Well,
Yeah, so that's something I really like.
I'm not trying to
I
call
like.
anybody out, but they often have them at a gas station that's on every corner in this city. So there you go.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I want to I want to talk about from your perspective, Gifty, this event that you're participating in for International Women's Day. What's a main takeaway that you're hoping to leave with the audience who attends that event?
Considering the theme has something to do with diversity, my takeaway would be, or what I would want to leave with the people in attendance would be my perspective of the world, what being a woman looks like in Ghana, sharing this with them, and then maybe show them a few things from back home, because I'll have a stand with the pictures, and I intend to bring along some Ghanaian food too to show. So that's something
Oh,
to leave
fun.
with the
That
people.
sounds like fun. That sounds like fun. Gifty Amedota has been our guest today, along with Erica Kuhnman, and they're here talking about an event on celebrating International Women's Day. The event is Tuesday, March 5th, from 5 to 7 at the UWL Student Union. It's upstairs in the Bluffs room there. So let's see, Gifty, Erica, thank you very much for joining us on Newsmakers today.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. There are a couple of opportunities to hear our show every week. We're on Friday morning at 10 on the Ideas Network 90.3. We're on Friday night at 7 on NPR News and Music 88.9. And we're always online at WPR.org. If you'd like to get in touch with me, if you have an idea for the show or something you think we should be talking about, just send me an email, newsmakers@WPR.org. That's newsmakers@WPR.org. I'm Ezra Wall. Join us again next week for another Newsmakers here on Wisconsin Public Radio.